How green is your city? In recent years, architects and urban planners have championed an effort to make urban areas more eco-friendly. But that effort may be misguided, according to Des Fitzgerald, author of The Living City, Why Cities Don't Need to Be Green to Be Great. Des is a professor of medical humanities and social sciences at University College Cork and has been named a new generation thinker by the BBC and the Arts and Humanities Research Council. Here he is to share five of his big ideas.
Hi, my name is Des Fitzgerald. I'm a professor of medical humanities at University College Cork in Ireland, and I'm the author of The Living City, Why Cities Don't Need to Be Green to Be Great. Let me give you five key insights from the book. So insight number one, the future of the city is actually kind of retro. There's a really interesting urban project out there right now called Telosa. It's led by a highly successful entrepreneur called Mark Lurie, and it's a project to build a new city from scratch somewhere in the United States. They haven't quite decided where yet. Now, the folks behind this have maybe the same intuition that a lot of us have, which is that our cities are not really working as well as we want them to. They're not sustainable and efficient. There's a lot of inequality. Urban governance doesn't always seem so great. And the city is often just not a nice place to be. It's not welcoming. It's not inclusive. It's often hard and stressful. The project is underpinned by an economic philosophy that they call equitism. And this is based on the idea that once you start building somewhere, once you start developing an area of land, the value of that land goes up by quite a lot. But under equitism, instead of all this new value simply going to the individual or the corporation who happened to own the land, it goes into a collective endowment held by the community. And the money earned by that endowment goes back into the community for projects like healthcare and education and so on. Mark Lurie says the inspiration behind this idea came from a Victorian economist called Henry George. That caught my attention. Henry George was also the inspiration behind a much older and much more famous project of urban renewal called the Garden City Movement, which began in England at the end of the 19th century and spread around the world in the following decades. Henry George was also the inspiration behind a much older and much more famous project of urban renewal, the Garden City Movement, which began in England at the end of the 19th century and spread around the world in the following decades. The idea behind the Garden City Movement was really quite similar to what motivates the folks behind Telosa, to build a greener, more natural, we would say more sustainable urban space, in contrast to the shocking inequality of the 19th century industrial city. So in my book, I visit one of these cities. It's called Welwyn Garden City. It still exists today. It's not far from London. And from there, I try to figure out just how much, and also why, our vision of the urban future in 2023 or 2024 is so close to what people were doing and planning and thinking 150 years ago in a completely different world. I think it might be a problem that the urban future, as so many people are thinking about it today, is so retro. It's so rooted in the economic and social thinking of the 19th century. You might even say, behind swooshy sci-fi architecture and, I don't know, drones delivering pizzas, we might not have much of an urban future at all. What we might have is something like a return, a backward step towards ideas about the city, about nature, about fairness, about what a good human life looks like, that at least in the good old 20th century, we thought we had left quite far behind. Insight number two. We talk a lot about nature, but I don't think we always know what that means. An idea that probably a lot of us have is that nature is good and we need more of it. And especially if we live in cities, we need to be in contact with nature. It's good for us. It keeps us calm and rested. Leaves and trees, they're just good stuff. They're good stuff for us. Now, obviously, there are studies backing all of this up. And for sure, we know pretty well that for a lot of people, at least some of the time, getting into nature is good for their mood. There's also a now kind of old idea first set out by the evolutionary biologist Edward O. Wilson called biophilia. Biophilia is the idea that because of our evolutionary inheritance, humans have a deep, unconscious affiliation with living things. And this has a lot to do with the much more natural environment that humans lived in before the, as it happens, fairly recent move to urbanization. One of the arguments my book makes, though, is that there's nothing unnatural about the city. There's just no good reason for saying that concrete, which is, by the way, a very old substance made entirely from natural materials and from things that we found on our planet, there's no reason for saying it's any less natural than wood. There's no reason to say that a lovely, warm, insulated and glazed tower block, constructed entirely from materials that we humans, we primates, found around us. There's no reason to say that this is less natural than, I don't know, a treehouse, say. The idea that a tower block isn't nature, you can certainly hold that view, but it's not particularly philosophically or even physically respectable. It's just a weird cultural prejudice. What if what we call nature isn't a kind of thing? It's not a substance or an environment. It's a moral idea we have about the world. It's a name we have for the idea that the way we live now is not good, that we're out of balance, and not just ecologically, but also psychologically. So what if we separate those two things? What if we stop trying to solve our many crises with a, frankly, fairy story about something we call nature? What if we gave up on, even more frankly, bad concepts like biophilia? Then maybe, just maybe, we could think better and more robustly about the world we actually want to live in. Insight number three. The relationship between mental health and the city is more complicated than you think. So we've known since at least the mid-19th century that there's something about the relationship between urban space and mental health. There's something about the experience of the city that, for some people, maybe they have a biological predisposition, can turn into a major health crisis. Ever since psychiatrists and epidemiologists first started to produce statistics about mental illness based on populations that were in early asylums, we've known that living in a city, being born in a city, moving to a city, all increase the risk of mental illness. In 1939, two sociologists called Robert Farris and Warren Dunham actually mapped the rates of different psychiatric diagnoses across different neighborhoods in Chicago. They were able to show that, for example, what they called social disintegration in a particular neighborhood mapped pretty closely to the incidence of psychosis in that same place. But we don't know why any of this is, and that's despite more than a century of research. More recently, people have turned to the physical environment as an explanation. So there's a lot of research now arguing that the relative absence of natural material, vegetation basically, in cities is what's causing this problem. In my book, I argue that it's undoubtedly the case that there is a strong and maybe even causal role between urban life and mental illness for many people. But first, there's not something essential about the city that causes this. There's no mystical, unique quality of cityness that has this effect on people. And second, if you really want to disaggregate what it is about city life that sometimes has this effect, if you want to pull out the different factors that are playing a role, then contact with green space, though it's a nice story, is surely going to be much further down the list of things that we know cause a huge amount of stress and distress for people in cities. Things like insecure housing, precarious employment, work pressure, inequality, a sense that life is just too much of a struggle. And so I worry that when we're telling people in cities to look after their health by, I don't know, taking their lunch break in a park or buying a plant for their office, and these are all real solutions, by the way, we're turning away from the boring, hard, complicated social problems that lots of people just don't want us to look at. And especially, frankly, that powerful and wealthy people don't want us to look at. It's just much easier and cheaper to tell people to go visit a forest at the weekend than it is to legislate for, say, minimum work contracts, than it is to build mass social housing. And of course, there's loads more to be said here. There's big debates to be had about all of that. But at a minimum, I want to say, if we want to take urban stress seriously, if we want to take the relationship between mental health and urban stress seriously, we really, really need to stop talking about trees. Insight number four, your architectural preferences are political. There's an experimental town, or really an extension to an existing town in the west of England. It's called Punbury. It's built on land owned by the Duchy of Cornwall and is intellectually driven by the one-time Duke of Cornwall, the man we now know as King Charles III. Since the 1980s, Charles has been a major public opponent of modern architecture and someone who has argued forcefully for more traditional building styles. So, for example, he favours the kind of streetscape or the urban arrangement that would have been built in England in, say, the early 1800s, a nice, modest, symmetrical, human-scale Georgian terrace. Now, there's an argument out there, and Charles certainly buys into this, that architecture affects our well-being. Maybe it'd be better to say there's an argument that architecture somehow affects our soul. That modern architecture is kind of soulless, that it's boring, it's not built for people, it has abandoned the accumulated knowledge and wisdom that architects built up over centuries. And from there you get to the claim that traditional or classical styles make us actually feel better. They're nicer to be in, they might even make us into better kinds of people. In my book, I show that what imagines itself as an aesthetic argument about style, or maybe a health argument about architecture and well-being, is really a political argument. It's an argument about the social and economic values expressed by our built environment. This was actually set out with admirable clarity by the conservative philosopher Roger Scruton in the 1970s. Scruton was an incredibly influential opponent of modern architecture, which in his view was not just bad or ugly, it was immoral. It was, for Scruton, the product of an immoral society. I do think we need to start hearing people who talk about traditional style as also talking about traditional morality, as making a sometimes conservative argument in favor of the kinds of hierarchical, unequal, even undemocratic social and political arrangements that held throughout much of the world before the 20th century. And that's perfectly reasonable, people can make that case, but at least others who don't like that, then they need to start taking the built environment seriously. We need to start learning to appreciate the architectural fabric of the modern world, because that fabric symbolizes, contains, and holds together things that at least I personally value a lot. Things like the welfare state, mass housing, democratization, even consumerism, diversity, surprise, fun. There's an architectural politics to all of this, and it's happening whether we like it or not. Insight number 5. Urban utopia is a bad idea. I remember when I first went to Welland Garden City, which, by the way, is a really nice place. You should visit it if you're nearby. But it's basically a wealthy suburb. And I remember thinking, this is certainly a utopia, but whose utopia is not exactly clear. The social and economic vision of the Garden City movement is long gone, and what's left in its place is really just a symbolically gated enclave for the rich, its roads lined with SUVs and big cars, its premium laneways full of nice housing. The bad idea that people like Ebenezer Howard, the founder of the Garden City movement, had, the bad idea that we still have today, is that the city is a technology for fixing the world. That there's some kind of horizon of collective, social, and also psychic repair where we fix our buildings, we plan some nice modest housing estates, we put some green stuff on the roof, we try and get everything within a nice short walk of your house. There's a fantasy that this is the recipe for a good society of the future, that the physical environment and disciplines like architecture and planning are a kind of royal road to a better future. You see this in the huge-scale greening of cities like Paris. You see it in the idea of the 15-minute city. You see it in planned new cities and towns from Saudi Arabia to provincial England. What would be different, though, if we could set these visions to one side and learn to love the real, actual, living places we have now, in all their mess and diversity and confusion, and yes, their inequality and stress? That doesn't mean giving up on the idea of improvement. But it does mean maybe no longer postponing the future to something that's never going to happen, some kind of sci-fi fantasy in which all the social and political problems that we face just disappear as if by magic under the gleaming facade of a future world. The living city is an argument for the here and now. It's an argument for the small and the local and the dysfunctional and the weird. It's an argument for the kinds of places that many of us currently live in, places that many of us love, places that maybe just don't need to be fixed. Well, that's all I got. Thanks for listening. I really hope you enjoy the whole book.
Thank you, Des. That was Des Fitzgerald with 5 big ideas from The Living City, Why Cities Don't Need to Be Green to Be Great. I'm Michael Kovnat. Have a great day.